From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Another 1.4 million people filed for unemployment last week, the first uptick in weekly unemployment filings since March, a reflection of the piecemeal shutdown across the U.S. as COVID-19 surges in different states.
Meanwhile, pandemic unemployment benefits, the $600 weekly bump that everyone on unemployment was getting, are set to end in just over a week. And there are just 2 weeks until Congress goes on its August recess. For more, we have NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. Hi, Kelsey. So Republicans, Democrats, and the White House all want another relief bill. How likely does it seem at this point that they'll find an agreement in the next week or two?
You know, it will be challenging. Republican leaders, particularly in the Senate, say that it is their goal to do that. But we have not yet seen the final bill from Republicans that would be the starting point for any kind of bipartisan negotiations. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, had a press conference this morning. And basically, they said they can't begin negotiating against nothing. They need to know where Republicans are, and they need to know that Republicans all agree on where they are before they can even begin to start talking about where a final bill will go.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about that. So Democrats want to extend these $600 extra in unemployment benefits. Republicans don't want to continue them in this current form. What can you tell us about some of the GOP proposals for another relief bill?
So what we know about the conversation right now isn't final. We do know that Republicans left a meeting last night saying that they had an agreement in principle, and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin spoke outside of the White House today saying that they've made some more progress. What we do know is that they agreed to $105 billion for schools, with money set aside for all schools and additional separate money set aside for just the schools that reopen in a traditional in-person fashion. So it'll be interesting to see how Democrats respond to that, because it's a new approach to all of this. They're also talking about $16 billion in new testing money, no payroll tax cut that the president had asked for. And the big thing they're still working on is that unemployment question. Mnuchin said the $600 in weekly benefits, like you said, they don't want to extend that. And instead, they're talking about some sort of 70% wage replacement. So they would go through and calculate how much unemployed people were making before and send out money around 70%, but they said it won't be more than $600 a week.
Some other things in this bill. The president wanted a payroll tax cut to stimulate the economy. GOP senators dismissed this, and now it's not on the table anymore. What else are they breaking with the president on?
You know, it's hard to know because they haven't really said. The White House has not been very present here. It's hard to know what the president wants because he's been absent from these conversations. You know, just as he was from the previous conversations about coronavirus aid. As before, this is being negotiated by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, and this time with White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. It is very unusual to be in this position where it is the White House staff negotiating without a president present.
Let's switch gears for a second. So a House vote last night to remove Confederate statues from the Capitol succeeded with bipartisan support. Is it going anywhere in the Senate?
Well, at this point, it does not look like it will be well received in the Senate, in part because Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell addressed this question before, and he said the removal of Confederate statues is a bridge too far. He called it an attempt to airbrush the Capitol. Part of the argument that he's made here is that there is an agreement between Congress and the states that allows states to have two statues of their choosing in the Capitol. He basically said that voting to remove those statues would violate that agreement, and he's turned to the Senate Rules Committee to go through and kind of work through a way to work with states to replace some of the statues that are in question in that House bill.
One more question for you. So President Trump is called to change how we divide up seats in Congress by excluding unauthorized immigrants. Now House Democrats are going to hold an emergency meeting about the census. How much authority do the president and Congress actually have here?
So that is a really interesting question, because the president is claiming authority here that Congress also is claiming. They're saying that constitutionally they have the authority over what is considered in the census. And I can imagine that this is going to be a long and drawn out conversation, likely up until the election, because this gets to the root of a conflict between Democrats and the White House over immigration in general and about who should be counted in this country.
That's NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. As always, thank you so much, Kelsey.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you want to enter a shop, you'll have to wear a mask. And the British government says people who fail to comply will face a fine of up to £100. That's around $130. This rule is already in effect in Scotland. How will it play out in England? Will there be scenes like this one in a California supermarket?
So anyone harassing me to wear a mask, you guys are violating federal law. Did you get that? Get that on camera,
ma'am.
That shopper without a mask said she had her doctor's permission to not wear one. Let's bring in Patty Lillis, who is General Secretary of the English Shop Workers Union, USDAW, the Union of Shop, Distributive, and Allied Workers. He joins us from Liverpool on Skype. Patty, you say your workers are a little worried about this.
Well, look, it's always a concern when you introduce any measure. And we have seen over the years the violence and abuse towards retail staff. And yes, it has doubled during this pandemic. And the mind boggles when you have individuals who are in their providing a service for their communities, for a small minority who think it's okay to abuse them. So yeah, this could be a flashpoint area. But in relation to face covering, I mean, it's a small price to pay to keep yourself, your colleagues and your community safe. And we have been calling for this mandatory wearing of face covering for several months now. So we are pleased to see it been introduced from tomorrow.
Well, so you're pleased because you think for the general good, it is a good idea. And actually, by the way, it protects your shop workers. But you just said something interesting. There was already, you know, kind of abuse towards shopkeepers before the pandemic.
We've been running our Freedom from Fear campaign for some 20 years now. And we are seeing year on year increases of violence and abuse towards retail workers. Just in the UK alone, there's over 400 assaults every single day on retail workers. So this is something we have had to contend with for many years. This emergency we're in now has doubled the number of instances. We are working closely with the employers, the employer associations, the police and other groups to ensure that people can go to work and be safe whilst at work.
So other people wearing masks protects your union members, the people who are serving them, who have to go to work to make a living, who will be wearing masks as well. But how do you, I mean, how is this going to be enforced? And who helps these shopkeepers when they come across someone who may get abusive because they don't want to wear a mask?
Well, look, we are fairly confident that the vast majority of the general public will adhere to the law and will wear it. We've got the example of Scotland. Scotland introduced it several weeks ago, and nearly 99% of people are wearing masks without any problems. So, again, we are fairly confident that this will go off fairly easily. However, you mentioned people with health issues. There will be a case where people will have health issues and disabilities. They're excluded from it. And again, they can download a pass that can show that they've got a health issue and therefore are exempt from wearing the mask, as are children under the age of 11. But let's not lose sight of it. This is a deadly disease. Anything we can do to stop its spread has got to be a good thing. And by the way, you know, the mask, the face coverings is only one part of the armoury to defeat this. Social distancing from ours is absolutely clear. 2 metres must be maintained. Hand washing, sanitising, all of that. Limited numbers in stores, proper queuing, all of that is all part of trying to eradicate this virus.
Yeah. Same thing we're doing here in the States, in many parts of the States. I'm thinking, too, that while this is a way to eradicate the virus, require everyone wear masks in shops, socially distance, all the people who work in shops wearing masks, it's about eradicating the virus. This is also about keeping livelihoods for your members going, because if this doesn't work, if people don't wear masks, they're going to have to shut down again.
Well, the economy has suffered badly. This is probably a bigger recession from the financial tsunami we had in 2008. So we're clear. The government intervention has been welcomed in terms of job retention schemes, business interruption loans for businesses. But we have still seen unprecedented numbers of job losses, big high street names taking off huge numbers of employees. And this is only the start. So again, we're doing all we can to secure the retail sector. But I would point this out. The retail sector has been in some difficulty for over 10 years with the bricks and mortar versus the online retailers. So again, we have been calling on government for a retail strategy. for the future. We all want to see our high street survive, but it takes a willingness of all the parties to be working to look, what does the future look like?
A lot at stake. Patty Lillis, General Secretary of the English Shop Workers Union, USDAW. Patty, best of luck to you and your members tomorrow when masks become mandatory for customers there in British shops. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Thanks a lot.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Bard College at Simon's Rock, where students who crave intellectual freedom can begin college after the 10th or 11th grade. Bard College at Simon's Rock unleashes students' curiosity through a rigorous liberal arts and sciences curriculum and puts them on track toward completing a bachelor's degree 1 or 2 years early. Now accepting applications for fall 2020. simons-rock.edu/now. Where independent minds get their start.
You're no doubt hearing comparisons between President Trump's 2020 re-election campaign and the campaign of Richard Nixon in 1968. President Trump is emphasizing law and order in response to nationwide protests after the death of George Floyd. And when Nixon was a candidate, he did the same thing during a period of unrest in the 1960s over civil rights and the Vietnam War. President Trump is also repeating a phrase made famous by Richard Nixon, the silent majority. Let's talk more about this with Angie Maxwell. She's the director of the Diane Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society at the University of Arkansas. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
So, Angie, President Trump recently tweeted, "The silent majority is stronger than ever." What do you hear in that phrase?
Well, as you know, that phrase has a complicated history. And in 1968, when Nixon used that phrase, he was trying to occupy the middle between Democratic nominee Hubert Humphrey and George Wallace, the segregationist governor of Alabama, who was running as a third-party presidential candidate. And he was doing that while the two parties, the two major parties, were realigning. Republicans had split over the issue of civil rights. And then, of course, the Democratic Party had an influx of new African-American voters, particularly in the South, with 1968 being the first presidential election cycle since the Voting Rights Act. So the silent majority was an attempt to kind of occupy the middle. But of course, Trump is not the middle. After 4 years of his administration's actions, you know, the phrase, you know, kind of rings hollow. He's not Nixon. He's Wallace, right? And his supporters are anything but silent.
I want to go back to Richard Nixon. He made a speech in November of 1969 when he was the president, and he used that phrase, the silent majority. He was trying to win support for his plan for the Vietnam War. Let's listen.
Let historians not record that when America was the most powerful nation in the world, we passed on the other side of the road and allowed the last hopes for peace and freedom of millions of people to be suffocated by the forces of totalitarianism. And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support.
It's really interesting listening to that and hearing what you said, that Trump is not Nixon, he's Wallace. But the political thinking then was that there was a large group of Americans who supported the war but stayed out of politics. Was that true, though? And was there a silent majority in the late 60s, really?
I think in the South, which, you know, Nixon was very concerned about continuing to make inroads in the South, there were what I would call people who, for lack of a better term, liked their racism polite. So they didn't want to have to defend overtly aggressive policies like a George Wallace. And they didn't join those protest movements for civil rights. And they, you know, lumped in a lot of Vietnam protesters as part of this growing, as Wallace had called it, hippie agitators, these folks who wanted to change the status quo. Nixon was trying to say it's fringe. It's a small faction. And those of us who are good Americans want to maintain and conserve this status quo that we're in. But I think what we're seeing in 2020 is a very different situation, because we have seen attitudes dramatically shifting on Black Lives Matter and on police brutality against African Americans. We haven't seen numbers move like that since the big flip in attitudes we had towards gay marriage between, 2010 and 2015. And so it doesn't work, this kind of silent majority appeal, if one, it's not silent, it's not done politely, it's aggressive, it's overt demonization of protesters. And also if the majority of Americans are showing warmer or approval attitudes of organizations like Black Lives Matter. My guess is Trump's using it for two reasons. He likes the idea personally that the polling is wrong, that there's some kind of silent majority who supports him. And two, it's an attempt to stop the bleeding in terms of his support. His unfavorable numbers are so high now, and that makes those people who were on the fence feel less alone, that they're part of something bigger.
And we know that President Trump is very much about image. So would you say that this is more so spin, that there are silent supporters out there, but that may not be the silent majority?
Oh, I definitely think there's some silent supporters. But I mean, Trump supporters are not all very silent. Again, trying to occupy a middle, but he's not a middle. He's been far right on so many issues.
He's been far right on so many issues, but as the 2016 presidential election showed us, there were a significant amount of supporters, more than just a few fringe supporters. It's why he won the presidency.
Absolutely. It's completely fair point. I think that kind of one thing that is different in 2020, and I won't make predictions ever again after 2016, but in 2016, there were 13 states in which the number of people who voted for third-party candidates or write-in candidates was greater than the difference between Clinton and Trump. 13 states and one district in Nebraska, and that accounts for 155 electoral votes. Trump's also had 4 years of an administration. He's in the middle of a pandemic that's been handled badly, and he's running against a white male candidate. All of those factors pull away from that majority, so to speak, that he had. And so how much of it is, a silent majority? I mean, Trump makes it very difficult to defend these positions. It's not a coded racism, for example, that Nixon used with kind of benign neglect of civil rights enforcement. And Nixon made these kind of indefensible traditions defensible somehow. And Trump makes that difficult when he, in his tweets and in, his speeches and language.
You make a point that Joe Biden is also a white man. As we go into the presidential election, what are you thinking about in terms of our previous presidential election and Clinton being a woman up against Donald Trump?
I hate these facts, but we can't change what we don't acknowledge. But when we measure for something called modern sexism as political scientists, which is not a belief that women cannot do the job, but it's a distrust of women who want to do the job, that measure had about a 6-point effect. So it was strong as racial resentment was in terms of predicting vote for Obama. And yet we kind of fail to acknowledge it because it isn't overt. It is a tendency towards distrust. So if you look at what issues hurt Clinton, it wasn't that she wasn't strong enough to do the job or she was weak. It was issues related to trust, and we're primed to distrust, a woman who wants that job. And so that is not a factor in 2020. I'm not taking anything away from, Joe Biden's candidacy, but he's not even able to campaign a great deal because of the pandemic. And yet we see these numbers And so, you know, we have to remember that that's a factor, and we have to continue to get more and more comfortable with women that want to lead.
Of course, you say you're not going to make predictions, especially after 2016, but the polls show that presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden is ahead. But by presidential election standards, I mean, if we go by previous elections, at around this time, we're talking July, a lot can change between July and November.
It's true. I mean, in terms of polling and kind of what I know and understand, it's the Democrats to lose. Could there be an issue that comes up? Sure. But the combination, when we look at Trump's falling approval numbers, which are just a snapshot, when we look at the number of people who have organized since 2016, it puts a lot more states in play than were before. I remember talking to, you know, folks after the 2018 midterms that had really become energized for the first time in politics behind Stacey Abrams' candidacy in Georgia, Andrew Gillum's in Florida, and Beto O'Rourke's in Texas. And they were so disappointed when all three lost. But their organization and the people that they brought into the Democratic Party, those are can be permanent, you know, shifts. So that effort that's been put in, the big unknown is what coronavirus will do. That's still the big unknown. But in terms of favorability for Biden versus Trump and the lack of a strong third party candidate or even any third party candidate, it's definitely, you know, advantage Biden right now.
Angie Maxwell is the director of the Diane Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society, an associate professor of political science and holder of the Diane Blair Endowed Professorship in Southern Studies at the University of Arkansas. Angie, talking about the idea of the silent majority in the presidential campaign. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And it's opening day for baseball. Oh, wait. Delayed 4 months by the pandemic, a 60-game shortened season does begin tonight with the defending World Series champion Washington Nationals hosting the New York Yankees. Dr. Anthony Fauci scheduled to throw out the first pitch with no one there to cheer him on. This guy cannot get his moment. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, no fans whenever any of these games are going to be played. How are they going to keep players safe?
Well, the safety will, the number one thing they're doing is a lot of testing every other day. They have their own lab in Utah. At first, the testing results were a little delayed. That seems to have been handled. So players will know. I mean, there will be periods where a player, I suppose, could contract the virus and not know about it for a little while, but that probably won't go on for long. There'll be temperature on the way in. There's distancing in the dugout. For instance, usually if a pitcher isn't pitching that day, he would sit with his team in the dugout. Now he'll sit above them in the stands. There are plenty of empty seats.
Yeah. And as if we didn't know this was a different season, at the exhibition game the other night, the San Francisco Giants manager Gabe Kapler knelt for the national anthem along with some of his players to support the protests against racial injustice. And of course, you know, President Trump reacted. He tweeted out, "If I see kneeling, the game is over for me." Like, he's breaking up with baseball. But was the league supportive? I mean, what was the fallout from that?
Yeah, well, obviously President Trump loves that fight, and he tries to dredge it up even with the case of Bubba Wallace weeks after that incident where Wallace thought he saw a noose and it was investigated. The president was trying to make hay. He thinks this was one of his greatest triumphs, getting crowds to cheer against Colin Kaepernick. So he seized on this. But baseball is supporting the Giants. You know, Major League Baseball is less than 10% African-American. There were two African-American players on the Giants who did kneel. But we do have to note, I think, that baseball hasn't been historically very supportive of everyone who's taken such measures. And there was one player in baseball, a backup catcher on the A's named Bruce Maxwell, who took a knee last year. And no one supported him. No one on his team took a knee with him. And he's had a long, complicated life that includes substances and that includes a gun charge. Now he's playing in Mexico. Even though the A's said, okay, I don't know if they said we were sorry, but we'd like you back, Bruce. He'd rather not play in Major League Baseball. So for a long time, baseball, just because of the dearth of African-American players, I would say, has been the slowest league to embrace any form of social change. But this time around, they do seem at least to be not unsupportive of Gabe Kapler and the other members of the Giants.
Well, baseball is reflecting a large swath of the country, you know, making some sort of evolution in this point. We only have a few seconds, but I just want to ask the WNBA women's basketball. Their season resumes Saturday without some players who've dropped out to work on social justice full time. Are they in a bubble?
They're in a wobble. That's what they call the WNBA bubble. Yes, it's in Bradenton, Florida, where the IMG Academy is based, and all 12 WNBA teams will play there. And some great players are out. Elena Deladon because of health, others because of social justice. But yeah, full season's going to happen in their version of a bubble.
Okay, something to watch there. Mike Pesca, who hosts the daily podcast at justatslate.com and is our sports analyst. Mike, thanks as always.
Welcome.
Overt racism. It's easy to see those signs that said whites only water fountain. It's easy to hear an N-word angrily directed from a white to a black. But the systemic racism we all may be participating in is much harder. It's like that statue you never thought about, or that word you casually used, like calling unfair treatment a lynching. No. Lynching is a lynching. And there are more expressions like soul down the river, grandfathering in, cakewalk, all of them rooted in slavery. Rutgers University linguist Kristen Surrett says the way we use language influences the way we think about people, and it's time to revisit and expunge some of the terms we've grown up with. Professor Surrett, Kristen, joins us from New Brunswick, New Jersey. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And this is very much in the news. The Houston Association of Realtors recently said they're going to change the term master bedroom to primary bedroom because of the association of that word with a slave owner. You know, a lot of people were surprised. They didn't even think of the word master that way. But I'm wondering if people descendant of slaves maybe always thought of the word master that way when they heard master bedroom. Either way, thinking of it, not thinking of it, why does this matter?
Well, the language that we use to have conversations with each other can be positive. It can be a reflection of our identity. It can convey meaning to people and help to facilitate a conversation. But there are times where language can express implicit bias. The cases that you talked about earlier, whites only, those are cases of explicit bias. But language can very subtly convey ways in which we think about people and the world around us. We may not even be aware of it. People who heard that master was no longer being used by Master Sommelier and other examples might have been surprised because they don't immediately think of that connotation with a master and slave. But I assure you, there are people who are part of our population who do associate that practice and that history with that word. So I would say to the extent that language can be a way of expressing who we are and what our values are, and to the extent to which that language can either be a way to exclude people from a discourse or include them as key participants, then this is a great opportunity for us to revisit such terms.
You mentioned master sommeliers. These are the wine experts. They're removing the word masters. There have been calls to change the name of the Augusta Masters Golf Tournament. Mm-hmm. Very significant there because caddies had to be black until 1975. Black members not admitted till 1990. So, again, this word has such resonance for many. And I'm thinking that we can add another reason to change. you say inclusive. I would also say painful. Why would you want to cause someone pain if they're wincing when you use a word? But I'm wondering, too, if you think that many people who are saying now, gee, I never thought of that, on some level, we are. There's some reinforcement, perhaps if you are white, when you hear the word master, that you were part of the master class.
So this is a really great point to bring up. And a lot of the ways in which I got started thinking about this topic in the first place was by looking at the way in which language can convey gender bias. That really matters to me as a woman, especially a woman in academia. And I started to look around at all of the terms that are pervasive in our language that convey a particular kind of patriarchy, a particular kind of relation between men and women in a very binary, heteronormative way. And I started thinking, oh my goodness, as a parent and an educator, how unfortunate is it that all of these expressions are part of the way that we communicate?
Give us an example.
You know, talking about someone as a congressman, manning the booth, like the grandfather clause. I mean, that term alone is offensive for multiple reasons. And when you start to think about this as a conversationalist, that's one dimension. But I work on language acquisition. I specifically work on how children use caregiver speech as input to learn about the language. So to the extent to which all of these gendered and racially biased terms are part of our language, those are the data that children are using to learn language. Mm. How unfortunate is it that they're getting this implicit bias ingrained in the way that they're learning how to talk?
Well, you mentioned grandfather clause or grandfathered in. Mm-hmm. This is something that was adopted by Southern states in the Reconstruction era, post-Civil War. Anyone who was able to vote before 1867 was exempt from literacy tests and property requirements. Of course, Black people were not freed until 1865, so they weren't grandfathered in and were kind of re-enslaved by a lot of these laws because they couldn't, of course, pass some of these tests and they couldn't vote. And now, of course, grandfathered in means someone who's exempt from something because they had it before a law was passed. And you're mentioning it's not race, it's gender. We should also say it's xenophobia. Terms like gypped. Gypped was a slur against gypsies. Paddy wagon, a terribly derogatory reference to Irish immigrants being thrown in the back of one. But back to the hidden language of race. The tech industry, many people are still using master and slave to describe software and hardware, you know, one aspect controlling the other. But some companies are changing that. What a light bulb moment. Twitter is saying they're no longer going to use it. And here are some other examples. Cakewalk, we think of that as meaning something that's simple or easy. But it was a real thing. It was a dance performed by slaves on plantations. They were competing in these contests for a cake. Peanut Gallery referred to Blacks who were forced to sit in the back of a movie theater. Once you start looking, uppity, the pejorative uppity, as in Michelle Obama is.
It really is striking the extent to which expressions like this are part of our common vernacular, are part of the way that we talk without even thinking about their origin, their source. You know, you mentioned uppity. Another word that comes to mind is hysterical, which for gendered reasons, I think, is a term that I prefer to avoid. I think in a lot of cases, people aren't really thinking that the expression conveys that kind of racism or misogyny or any of that. They're not thinking. But I don't think that excuses it. I think this is a moment where we can take a hard look at the terms that we use and the messages that they convey and the extent to which they marginalize and hurt other people who we should be valuing, valid participants in our democracy and our conversation. And if we allow certain expressions to continue to be used, knowing full well that they convey that message, then I think that's incredibly unfortunate.
Well, uppity was an epithet used by whites during the Jim Crow era to describe newly freed Blacks who weren't deferential enough. That would seem coded, but then there are words that are so clear, blacklisted, black mark on someone's reputation, the word black, you know, the cowboys in the black hats were the bad guys. It does seem as if just being more conscious. I mean, I don't think I'm ever going to say soul down the river again.
Well, I don't know that I ever used that expression, but I do know that there are some of the expressions that you listed that I have used. And it's going to be hard. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, make it seem like, oh, we can just change it and it's no problem. It's hard. They're so ingrained in the way that we speak. I could draw an analogy between this and looking at how we use pronouns now. You know, pronouns are parts of our language, he, she, they, that we use all the time. And with a broader conversation about gender fluidity and people choosing to identify in a way that they feel most comfortable with, that means we have to shake up our pronoun system. That's going to be hard. Well, you know, it's hard, but let's at least try. Because if you stick to using expressions that you know convey a particular way of thinking about people, then you're really conveying something else, which is that I don't care enough about what matters to you to change the way I'm speaking.
That's Rutgers University linguist Kristen Surrett talking about the covert racism in language. Kristen, Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Got me thinking, in some of our lifetimes, there was a children's rhyme, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, that used the N-word. Unbelievable. Your thoughts, words you realize now have racist echoes. Let us hear about them at hearnow.org.
For this week's district profile, we turn to one of the House races called a toss-up by the Independent Cook Political Report. It's in Georgia's 7th Congressional District, northeast of Atlanta, where ER doctor Republican Rich McCormick and Democrat Carolyn Bordeaux, a college professor, are vying to fill an open seat. Emil Moffitt is a news reporter at WABE in Atlanta with more. Emil, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes. So first, can you describe the district and how it's gone in past elections?
This is a district that has been represented by a Republican for many, many years, but the district is changing. One of the counties contained in the district is Gwinnett County, which, as you mentioned, northeast of Atlanta. It makes up about 3/4 of the district, and it is a trended majority non-white in recent years, and that has really led to quite a bit more diversity, and it has led to these races being a lot closer than they have been in recent years. So while this has been predominantly a Republican district for many years, the demographics are changing there.
Let's talk a little bit about the candidates. So as I mentioned, Democrat Carolyn Bordeaux, she's a professor in the Policy School at Georgia State University in Atlanta. Here's a recent ad she released.
When I hear from families struggling to afford health care, I think of my own parents who drain their life savings to pay for prescription drugs. I'm Carolyn Bordeaux, policy expert, working mom, and a teacher, Democrat, running for Congress.
What are some of the issues that Carolyn Bordeaux is running on?
Well, I think she mentioned that right there at the top, health care, and especially amid the pandemic. Carolyn Bordeaux is someone who had parents who had dealt with illness late in their lives and struggled to pay for medical care to deal with those illnesses. And that really inspired her to run back in 2018 when she just barely narrowly lost by 433 votes. And she's focused on health care again and making it accessible to more people. And she says that the pandemic has just only exacerbated the problem of health care inequality in her district.
Republican Rich McCormick, that's who she's running against. He's a Marine veteran and ER physician at Gwinnett Medical Center in Lawrenceville. Here's one of his campaign ads.
In Congress, I'll protect America from the socialist fantasies of the left. Stand up to the squad. Build the wall and double down on the Trump economy. And I'll never let the liberals remove our president. I'm Rich McCormick. I'm a doctor, a Christian, a conservative, and a Marine.
So we heard a little bit there about how he's positioning himself, but can you tell us a little bit more about
Rich McCormick.
Yeah, it's interesting that obviously, as you mentioned, he is an ER doctor, so he's actually treated firsthand a number of coronavirus patients, so he has seen it up close. He's also talked about the response from the White House to the coronavirus pandemic as being kind of decentralized and letting the states handle it. And that's has been something that's really been a criticism for many. And he's using it as a compliment, I guess, a little bit. And he did receive well wishes from President Trump when he won the Republican primary. It was something that he did. But he's also not been very clear about whether he actually voted for Donald Trump back in 2016. He was asked about it three times in a debate a couple of months ago before the primary. And he said, well, I was overseas serving my country, but he definitely stands with the president and is a supportive, very supportive of the president, while at the same time kind of walking the line. And this is a swing district where Hillary Clinton won back in 2016. So it's an interesting line that he has to walk between being able to be supportive of the president and still appeal to mainstream voters.
Give us a little bit more context. You mentioned this particular area and the demographic there. Is there a lot of outside money and attention coming into this race?
There is. It's one of the things that Rich McCormick has criticized about Carolyn Bordeaux of taking that outside money. But it's just gotten a lot of attention, not only because of the closeness of the race last time. It's a district that's coming up with an empty seat, and therefore you have two competitors who have never held elective office before, neither have. And also, in the last couple of elections, the women in District 7 have shown a lot more willingness to consider a Democratic candidate than in the past, where it's been a strongly Republican demographic. And the women in that district are now starting to really be open-minded to voting for a Democrat this time around.
So with that momentum, what do the polls say right now?
It's still very, very close. The primaries were supposed to be a little more competitive than they actually were. Neither went to a runoff. So clearly these were the two candidates that voters wanted to see in the general election. And so it's still a toss-up. This is, as we mentioned, a district that was decided by just over 400 votes last time around, and it should be a very close race heading into the general election in November.
Amil Moffitt is a news reporter with WABE in Atlanta. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Imagine you just graduated from law school in the spring. You've been studying for the bar exam. But then you find out that because of COVID-19, that bar exam has been canceled. That's what's happening in many states. We'll find out what that means for aspiring lawyers next time, Here and Now.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.